All right, Krishna, everyone. This is Achyuta Bhava, and today is another Bhakti Wednesday. So I'm taking a question from the audience. This is a really good one. It's a tough question, but it's a good one. It goes like this. I've been feeling bugged about Krishna being male-bodied. I understand that he takes many forms, is all forms, but he is referred to as he, him throughout the scriptures and is generally thought of, as far as I can tell, in his masculine human form. Also, the conversation between Arjuna and Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita takes place on a battlefield. It does not get more yang than that. Why is this? Good question. I'll do my best. First of all, it's important to understand that the context of the Bhagavad Gita, which depicts it's showing a conversation between God and like one of God's friends. Think about that for a second, just like having a conversation, because Arjuna does not want to go to battle. And the context is that there's a civil war that's about to happen. So this is, whether historically or not, there was a Kurukshetra and so forth, and the events of the Mahabharata are historical or fictional or whatever. I don't want to get into that, but let's just say that this is clearly a the depiction, the battlefield is a depiction of the problem of material existence, right? Which is not about masculine or feminine. It's just a depiction of the problem that we face in this world, which is that people who are supposed to be part of one body of God are fighting with each other and trying to kill each other. And these are families that are warring and that are supposed to be united. And Arjuna doesn't want anything to do with it. And Krishna tells him, look, I know it's a bummer, but you're going to have to learn how to do yoga while this horrible reality of civil war also exists. That's the context of the Gita. It's not a glorification or an exaltation of war or the warrior spirit. It's a recognition, the Bhagavad Gita is, that life is really hard and that people here in this earthly plane are supposed to be all part of God's body, but are trying to kill each other and take things from each other and are living in ignorance and darkness. And in order to do something about it, you have to fight for good. And it sucks because the people that you have to fight against that are doing evil are ultimately a part of the same body of God. And that's hard. That's a hard situation. That's the context. It's not, in my humble opinion, it's not a masculine context. It's true to the nature of what we see going on in this world. Do I agree that a lot of war has been perpetuated by men? Yes, but I think the history of warfare has more to do with the nature of humanity than it has to do with the nature of men. That is just my humble opinion, and you're obviously free to disagree with me. So I think that human nature and material reality itself lends itself to these kinds of struggles, conflicts, desire, fear, hatred. It's also a place that's impermanent. So just to say that the Gita is really not about a battle, and it's really not about war as much as it is the lamentation that we face as human beings who have compassionate hearts, who want to do good, who want to be living in harmony with one another, who find ourselves having to deal with these inevitable events that are often quite terrible. How do we deal with that? How do we just run off to a cave? You know, so Krishna says, no, here's a way to do yoga while also having to engage in these very difficult conflicts. So that's my opinion about that. All right. The second one is, you know, why does Krishna show up as male-bodied? So this gets into the philosophy of bhakti yoga. And if it helps to think about these as, you know, this is philosophy that could be, you know, being understood. I don't think it's a good idea to try to strip traditions, gods and goddesses down to like literary metaphors, because it's very impersonal and it's very objectifying. So I don't generally think that's a good idea. But let's just do that game for a second. Let's just like kind of go through that exercise. We look at the religious imagination of bhakti. The idea is that God is both one and many. And in philosophy in the ancient world, whether it's Taoism or ancient, you know, astrological philosophy, the one is considered like yang, masculine. It has the single penetrating thrust of the creator. So it's an allusion to the sexual reproductive organs of men and things like that. But all of those are just metaphors. They're all just allusions to the idea of a singular source of creation, undifferentiated singular source. And in bhakti, we say that source is both being itself as well as a being. So it's not just some undifferentiated mass or blob of like, you know, divine sperm. It's also a being. Then, but that being should not properly be understood as a human man, right? Not like that. Then we say that that one is also simultaneously many, meaning that the one is also variegated. Just like I'm a soul, you're a soul, the trees, the planets, the stars. And so the one is also many. Like the sparks are to a fire or the sunbeams are to the sun. There is the sun ball and then there are the beams emanating from it. And they both exist simultaneously and are part of the same one thing. So there's difference and there's oneness existing simultaneously. In bhakti, we say that the difference is not an illusion. We say that the difference is real. And so, first of all, bhakti is a great proponent of the reality of feminine energy, whereas many monistic traditions will say that the yin, which means the many, me, you, the trees, the creation, everything other than that singular being, that's real. That other traditions will say that it's an illusion, that the feminine is essentially an illusion and there's only this undifferentiated singularity, which is essentially saying masculine over feminine or yang over yin. Bhakti's not like that. Bhakti says, no, the many is just as real and sacred and the two can't be separated. The one and the many are, they're joined. And so while Krishna represents the one and is sort of personified, you could say, as a man, but a very interesting one. He's blue or black. He has many different forms that he comes in and out of, four-armed forms, two-armed forms, baby forms, boyhood forms. He plays a flute. He's blue. He's black. He looks like a rain cloud. I mean, he's a very mysterious, magical, godlike figure, not like a typical man. He plays a flute. He's said to be like the ultimate the ultimate attractive, like pop star, you know what I mean? So this is, the cultural imagination is that's actually this one creative divine singular being, the one being. And yes, it's imagined alongside of the masculine for the reasons that I've explained in terms of like sexual anatomy and stuff like that. But then you have Radha, which is Krishna's lover, not married, by the way. That's really important. Because it's not like a proper union. It's a spontaneous union between teenagers, like teenage lovers in the countryside. You know, so Radha is like this, it's Krishna's, you know, teenage love. You know what I mean? And in a sense, we as individual beings are like Radha. The bhakti philosophy says that there is nothing that is actually constitutionally yang except for Krishna. Everything else, by its very nature, from being the other, as on the other part of the dyad, is more like Radha. In other words, even though I'm in a male body, I'm actually, as a spirit soul, feminine in relation to my source. But when we talk about feminine and masculine, we're not talking about the literal sex and gender categories of human life. Those are just, you could say that those are handy images, handy biological references to hang these philosophical concepts on. If, again, if we're stripping things down to the philosophical level and looking at these as like literary symbols in the religious imagination of bhakti. So if you, in most homes, you'll find that Radha and Krishna are side by side on the altar. Worshipping Radha, in a sense, means that you are aligning yourself with Krishna's girlfriend, you know? But what does that mean on a deeper level? Well, on one level, it means that if Radha is broadly representative of the highest potential of incarnated, differentiated beings to experience perfect bliss and union with the divine source, then anything you serve to Radha is in service to creation coming into deeper ecstatic union with its source. Serving the goddess means serving others on their path to divine love. That's what goddess worship sort of means in bhakti. But it also means quite literally that we're in the religious experience of bhakti. It's often conceptualized literally as, in my meditation, I'm trying to help the gopis. I'm trying to help Radha or anyone who serves the gopis or Radha to try to get closer to Krishna. That seems like a weird thing to say, right? But again, if you want to just strip it back, why do I do these talks? Why do I try to share bhakti with other people? Well, in a sense, in my own prayers to Radha, for example, I, you know, include my prayers to both of them because they're on our altar in our home. And I'll say, you know, may these talks that I do draw other souls to you in your perfect grace as the goddess who knows how to make Krishna happier than anyone else, who knows that intimacy with God more than anyone else. So the goddess is like a filter for channeling our desire to serve creation and serve other souls and coming into the desire to please and love and connect with God. That's what goddess worship means in bhakti yoga. And the connection with the goddess is so important because it's the connection to the one whose ultimate aim is to make Krishna happy. And that may sound like, well, that's all about Krishna. What about Radha? But the thing is that Krishna's ultimate desire is to please Radha. So it's reciprocal. So it's this, it's very, very beautiful. It's very romantic. And it is not, in my humble opinion, it is not dependent upon you feeling like you need to worship a man. Many Krishna bhakti traditions will focus some more on Krishna worship, some more on Radha worship. Either way, the two are inseparable from one another. The two are like a dyad. I'm going to read you something. This comes from a book that I really love called The Search for Sri Krishna, Reality the Beautiful. There is a conversation between one of the great teachers of bhakti yoga who was thought to be an avatar incarnation that was a combined incarnation of Krishna and Radha in the same body. This is called Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And he's like the, you know, teacher that's at the heart of a lot of the bhakti, Krishna bhakti traditions. He's having a conversation. Chaitanya is with a great, sort of like a great devotee, someone who really, really loves God and knows a lot about bhakti. So here's God asking questions of someone who knows a lot about bhakti, wanting to learn from them. It's pretty interesting to think that God is like, I want to learn from you. What do you know about loving God? Think about that for a second. That's the kind of intimacy that bhakti is inviting us into. And in this case, the person asking the question was said to be, again, an avatar incarnation of God that had both Krishna and Radha combined in the same form. That's interesting. Can you think of anything more than this? Then Ramananda Rai said, you asked me to quote scripture to support whatever I say, but here I won't be able to quote scripture from anywhere. Still, I have a new feeling within me. And if you would like to know that, I can explain it to you. In this way, one song was composed by Ramananda Roy. He introduced this song by saying, "Whether or not it will be pleasing to you, I do not know, but it seems to me that there is a stage which is even better than the meeting of Radha and Govinda. There is a stage where both of them, the positive and negative, are combined. No individual consciousness is clear, and one is searching another in self-forgetfulness. The searching of one party by the other is very strong and intense. This seems to be a more highly elevated love, union in separation. Radha and Govinda are so intense in their search of one another that even they have no consciousness of whether they have each other. Radharani sometimes experiences that even while Krishna is present before her, she fears losing him. That feeling becomes as intense as if she has lost him. They are together, but the apprehension that one may lose the other makes their meeting intolerably painful, just as a mother is always alert about the safety of her son. A mother thinks, oh, my son is out. Is he in an accident? This fear of separation is the symptom of deep love. One is searching the other. Krishna himself is overflowing with the feelings of Radharani, and they are so deeply embraced that one is lost in the other. Then Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu put his palm over the mouth of Ramananda Roy and told him, no further. Lord Sri Krishna is the fountainhead of all pleasure, and Srimati Radharani is the embodiment of ecstatic love of God. These two forms are united as one in Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So that's like the teacher that's at the center of our tradition, is the idea that there is a way in which Krishna and Radha are always one, even though they are separate. And so I think, you know, for people who struggle learning about bhakti and learning about the philosophy, especially because of the repetition of Krishna and the idea of a male form, it's important to remember that the Krishna bhakti tradition has always been deeply rooted in the marriage between the idea of God as the marriage of a divine masculine and feminine simultaneously. And that if you feel more aversion toward the divine masculine, there's two pieces of advice that I would give. One is I think that, you know, there could be some wounds there. It's understandable. It may also just not be attractive to you. In which case, the two pieces of advice would be maybe focus a little bit more on worshiping Radha, knowing that Radha and Krishna are connected. You can always just pray, Radha, I struggle with Krishna. I struggle with that form, or I struggle with the divine masculine. So as I worship you, the goddess, help me heal that, or help me understand. You know, and I think that prayer sincerely made can help bring the two into healthier relationship in your own soul. The bhakti tradition describes the soul itself as seated on a branch, like a bird, with the other bird as God. And so our own soul has a relationship with God that's not entirely different from the relationship that Radha has to Krishna. So we can, if we're hesitant, talk to Radha about it for sure. Or just focus on Radha. And in time, Radha will help take care of things, will help clear uncertainties or confusions or doubts or whatever, and bring it into a healthy space where it's like, it's a healthy thing and not not something that doesn't feel good to you. Now that's my first advice. And the second advice would be talk to Krishna about it. Like literally be like, Krishna, I'm not sure how I feel about the masculine. Or Krishna, I've had some wounds and I'm not sure that, you know, I'm not sure I know what to do about it. Either way, I think approaching God in love is really the point. And that point is far more important than the gender that we place on God, or even the lack of gender that we place on God. I hope that this is helpful. It's a very challenging question to answer, and I'm not sure of how well I've done. I would just leave by saying that the one and the many imagined as teenage lovers, right? That's really what this is all about. And maybe that looks a little bit different. Maybe the images that bring out that philosophical reality in your own heart and mind are a little bit different. But if you can understand what it's like to feel that passionate, you're not married yet. This is not God's wife. This is the passionate love between teenagers in the countryside. You know what I mean? 16 and in love. What does that look like to you? You know, that's Krishna. That's what we're trying to get at when we talk about Krishna and Radha. So, and when we say that Krishna is all forms, it's that, you know, it can be frustrating because like, well, if he's all forms, then why do we have to refer to it to God as a he? And I think that if you can understand where this is coming from, then it's nice to have forms. It's nice to have it's nice to have deities on our altars, because the more impersonal we get and the more we just rely on the philosophical, the metaphorical, the allegorical, it really strips what the heart needs, which are personal images and beings. Because ultimately, the ultimate reality of bhakti is that God is a being, God is a person, and that so are we. And ultimately, that relationship between the person of my soul and the person of God goes way beyond gender, goes way beyond sex or gender. So anyway, I hope that this has been helpful and in service to your question. And feel free to ask questions if anybody has them anytime. info@nightlightastrology.com. Put bhakti Q&A in the subject line. All right. Thanks so much, everyone. Hare Krishna.